Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled, City Council Hesitant to Help Pay for Demolition. Owner requests funding for plan to tear down part of crumbling Dubuque structure that could pose safety risk. It's written by John Cruz. As the owner of a deteriorating building in Dubuque attempts to demolish part of the structure, Dubuque City Council members were hesitant on Tuesday to contribute city dollars to help speed up the process. But the owner of the building claims that without that city funding, it could be months before the building comes down. Speaking with City Council members on Tuesday, Steve Emerson outlined his proposal to have the city contribute $500,000 towards his planned demolition of the southern portion of the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building. "I came to Dubuque 6 years ago to do the right thing, and it's been a very costly mistake," Emerson said. "This plan recycles all the materials that we can, salvages whatever we can, and opens the street in the absolute fastest timeline that is possible." City officials had been demanding for months that Emerson stabilize the building since an analysis of the structure in August determined it to be a significant danger to the public, prompting the closure of Jackson Street from East 29th to East 32nd Street. City Council members in recent months have been pressuring for the building's condition to be remedied in some way so that Jackson Street can be opened, given that the road closure has financially harmed nearby businesses and made life more inconvenient for residents living around the structure. "This is about people being able to sleep at night in their homes and be safe," said City Council member Kathy Wethel. "This is about public safety." While Emerson had initially made efforts to brace the structure to prevent any further danger to the public, continued delays to develop an adequate bracing system prompted him in December to move forward with demolition. City staff have previously stated that the demolition of the portion of the building would eliminate any potential dangers to the public and allow for the reopening of that part of Jackson Street. Housing and Community Development Director Alexis Steger said the city had already given Emerson the go-ahead to commence asbestos abatement of the structure, which must be completed before demolition can begin. The city must also secure approval from local utility companies to ensure that demolition can proceed safely. Emerson said he intends to begin asbestos abatement next week when the weather improves, but, speaking with the Telegraph Herald, he said he must first secure additional financing to fund the demolition before it can proceed, which is why he's now asking for the city to contribute $500,000. But city council members on Tuesday said they believe the city has already spent enough money on keeping the portion of Jackson Street closed to keep the public safe and expressed wariness over contributing any more funds to Emerson. Steger informed city council members that the partial closure of Jackson Street has already cost the city $75,000. "I understand further city money could be helpful and speed the timeline up, but it just doesn't seem to be the proper use of public funds right now," said Mayor Brad Kavanaugh. "What I would hope that we can figure out is how you can work with other private entities to get this done." However, Emerson told the Telegraph Herald that without the city's funding, he would need to secure a bank loan to fund the demolition, which would require him to get the building reappraised, a process that he said could delay the demolition up to 6 months. "If I need to go to the bank, it's going to be a very long process," Emerson said. Since Emerson's proposal was not officially on the council agenda on Tuesday, city council members took no vote on it. Emerson said he hopes to present a formal proposal to the city in the next few weeks outlining his demolition plan and request for funding. Emerson, a Cedar Rapids, Iowa-based developer, purchased roughly 125-year-old Brewing and Malting Company building in 2017 with plans to convert the structure into a combination of residential units and commercial space. While the project so far has failed to secure enough funding to move forward, Emerson said he still intends to convert the remainder of the facility into new housing after the demolition is completed. Next, supervisors vent over size of raises recommended. Dubuque County Compensation Board has called for significant pay increases for county officials. This is written by Benjamin Fisher. Dubuque County supervisors on Tuesday were united in their frustration with a recommendation made for raises for elected county officials and their deputies, but were split on how to respond. Each year in Iowa, county compensation boards, whose members are appointed by county elected officials, recommend pay increases for elected officials and their deputies. Boards of supervisors either can accept those recommendations or roll them all back equally across positions. In most recent years, the Dubuque County Compensation Board and Board of Supervisors have been at odds over the recommendations, which have included such high increases for some elected officials that supervisors' rollbacks would reduce other county employees' raises to the point where they would be negligible. This approach by the Compensation Board has been aimed at boosting pay for the sheriff and other specific positions to bring them in line with the salary for similar positions in other similarly sized counties, and to ensure they are competitive with positions with similar duties. Those are the considerations on which compensation boards are allowed to base their recommendations per state law. But supervisors said Tuesday that they consider it a loophole by which they repeatedly are put in a difficult position. For some reason, most of the compensation board thought that they had to go really high because we were going to roll back, Supervisor Harley Potthoff said of the compensation board's recommendation for the coming fiscal year. Well, if you come with a reasonable request, it doesn't have to be cut. What they ended up with, I do not think, is a realistic thing. At a meeting in December, compensation board members recommended significant pay increases for the county's elected officials, 19% for the sheriff, 10% for the auditor and treasurer, and 8% for the county attorney, recorder, and 3 supervisors. In addition to the 8 elected officials, the percentage pay increase the supervisors approve will apply to deputies whose salaries are tied to the officials, 16% for the sheriff, 7% for the auditor, 4% for the treasurer, and 2% for the recorder. It seemed at Tuesday's work session that the supervisors had lost patience with this latest high recommendation. I know we cannot request that the compensation board meets again, but my understanding is that if they choose to, they can do that and make a new recommendation, said Supervisor Wayne Kenneker. I suggest we make it known that they have the time. Without that adjustment, the path I would prefer to take is that we reduce this recommendation by 100%. The option Kenneker mentioned would mean 0% pay increases for the 8 officials and 29 associated deputies in the fiscal year starting July the 1st. Kenneker said he would hate for the supervisors to take that path, but that he thought it irresponsible to approve officials' increase at the rates even traditional rollbacks would provide, because they would hamper supervisors' ability to give planned raises to other county employees. Supervisor Ann McDonough said she shared her fellow supervisors' frustration. I don't think it's appropriate, and it isn't in the code for the compensation board to go really high because they expect us to roll back, she said. But in my experience, asking them to meet again is not appreciated and does not go well. I also do not think we should consider rolling back 100% because that seems threatening to me. This tactic is based on a lack of trust, and I don't think threatening 100% rollbacks is going to do anything to address the lack of trust. Pay is personal. Finding people is hard. People will dust off their resumes. McDonough is the only sitting Dubuque County supervisor who was serving when the Board of Supervisors voted to send a message to the Compensation Board with a 75% rollback in 2020. McDonough also voted against that motion. Kenneker stressed that his 100% rollback idea was not meant as a threat, but as a worst-case scenario he felt the supervisors could be forced to take. Potthoff would not join McDonough in denying Kenneker's 0% raise option outright, but said he did not think it would be necessary. I don't think it's off the board, he said, but I think we have a path with these rollbacks. Dubuque County Budget Director Stella Rundy has given us. The Board of Supervisors' preference would be for the initial schedule of increases proposed by one of their representatives on the Compensation Board, 5.7% for Sheriff, 4.5% for the Auditor and Treasurer, and 3.2% for the Recorder, Attorney, and Supervisors. Kenneker said he also would entertain something near 5% across the board. McDonough stressed that she intended to provide raises no matter what. Dubuque County's population was ranked 9th among Iowa counties, according to 2022 estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau. As of Tuesday, the Dubuque County Sheriff's salary was ranked 11th in the state. Other officials' current salaries ranked higher than the county's population rank: 6th for supervisors, attorney, and recorder, 7th for treasurer, and 8th for auditor. However, compensation board members previously noted that the difference between those local wages and comparable positions in other counties was slight. The supervisors plan to resume their compensation board discussion with more information from Rundy at an upcoming meeting. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today is entitled "Woman Remembered for Relentless Support of Those with Disabilities." Longtime Hills & Dales CEO Marilyn Althoff has died at age 66. This is written by Grace Neeland. Marilyn Althoff was always looking forward. During her 16-year tenure as CEO of Hills & Dales, she consistently pushed the Dubuque organization to be its best, and she never settled for good enough. She was always looking for new, innovative services to offer, and by her retirement in 2021, the nonprofit had tripled its clientele. She was relentless, said Jack Mesher, current CEO of Hills & Dales. Everyone who knew Marilyn knew she had a twinkle in her eye for change. She was always looking for pioneering resources, always asking, what's next? Marilyn Althoff of Earlville died Friday, January the 12th, from complications related to ALS. She was 66 years old. Born March 25, 1957, Marilyn grew up in Earlville as one of seven kids born to Matthias and Alberta Ronnenbaum. Marilyn's mother was her first and most influential teacher, passing on myriad life lessons about kindness and love. A lot of Marilyn's characteristics came from her mother, said Gary Althoff, Marilyn's husband. She really respected her and loved her dearly. At age 5, Marilyn contracted polio, which left her with a slight limp and a lifelong respect for people facing physical hardships. She attended Beckman Catholic High School, where she met Gary after a welcome dance arranged for the students. Gary was taken with Marilyn quickly, won over by her quick wit and ever-present smile. On October the 20th, 1973, the two were wed. Marilyn started in the caregiving field as a stay-at-home mom for the couple's three kids, Tammy, Shannon, and Josh. The pair later gained a bonus child, Max Gordon, an exchange student from Central America who stayed with the family one school year. "Mom was like our rock," said Marilyn's daughter, Tammy March. "You could go to her with any problem or any concern, and she's not going to judge you. She's just going to help you." When the kids got older, Marilyn worked for a time at Good Neighbor Home, an assisted living facility in Manchester, before joining Hills & Dales in 1989. At that time, the organization mostly dealt in residential care for children with disabilities. In the year 2004, Marilyn was tapped as the organization's CEO. She went on to oversee several service expansions, including the addition of the nonprofit's autism services clinics and adult-oriented community integration programs. Her dedication to clients was mirrored by her dedication to staff, Mercer said. Many simultaneously saw her as a boss, mentor, and friend up until and even after her retirement in 2021. Her ability to truly see people was what set her apart, Mesher said. She saw everyone for who they were, whether it was her employees or the clients. She never failed to see the hidden potential in every person. Marilyn applied her attitude for change to her advocacy for disabled individuals at the local, state, and federal level. When the Mississippi River Walk was being redone, for example, she pushed to make it an accessible attraction for all. She also visited the Iowa State Capitol and U.S. Capitol to advocate for the missions and clientele of Hills & Dales. Marilyn was really good at meeting people where they were and having a conversation with them about what Hills & Dales was and why it was important, recalled State Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta. "A lot of people come in and demand you do something, but Marilyn Moore took the approach of really just highlighting why she loved the organization so much." Outside of work, Marilyn relished any opportunity to travel. Over the years, she and Gary visited 49 out of the 50 states, only missing Alaska when their cruise was canceled because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Most of the couple's trips were made by car, exploring one region at a time as their schedules allowed. Marilyn preferred warmer climates, once booking a spontaneous weekend trip to Cancun to escape the frigid Iowa winter. She wouldn't drive her Volkswagen in the winter months, but she loved to drive around in the summertime with the top down, Gary said. She always really loved when the grandkids would hop in and they could cruise around. Marilyn's other joys included making music and watching the Iowa Hawkeyes. She had a 12-string guitar she taught herself to play, and she was a frequent singer at local weddings and Sunday church services. Above all, however, Marilyn enjoyed time with family. She adored each of her children and grandchildren and gained the title of Fun Grandma for her willingness to always offer extra helpings of ice cream and other treats. She spoiled, in capital letters there, those grandchildren, said Deanne Althoff, Marilyn's daughter-in-law. She was always trying to make them feel special and always trying to make them laugh. Recently, Marilyn learned the name of her great-grandchild-to-be, expected to arrive next month. She was the only family member to learn the name ahead of the birth, a secret she kept. If you met my mom, she really left an impression, Tammy said. That's really come through in this last little bit with all the messages we've received from people who knew her way back in childhood. She will certainly be remembered. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, top story, jury finds man not guilty of attempted murder in Dubuque. Ruling comes after 3 days of testimony from law enforcement and witnesses in the case of an alleged assault in June of 2021. A Dubuque jury has found a man not guilty of attempted murder following a 3-day trial. Frederick T. Woods, Jr., age 30, of Peoria, Arizona, was charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with attempted murder, willful injury causing serious injury, domestic assault, impeding airflow, operating a vehicle without the owner's consent, child endangerment, and domestic assault, third or subsequent offense. The jury Tuesday afternoon found Woods not guilty on all charges, to which he responded with visible relief, including a sigh and quick embrace with his defense attorney, Joey Hoover. Both Hoover and Assistant Dubuque County Attorney Jonathan Dunn declined to comment after the verdict. The jury's decision came after 3 days of testimony from law enforcement officers, medical professionals, and the reported victim. The trial began January the 10th, but was delayed for several days due to severe winter weather. The now-dismissed charges stemmed from a June 2021 incident in which Brianna M. Hansen, then age 30, of Dubuque, was assaulted in her home, according to court documents, requiring her hospitalization and extensive rehabilitation services. Hansen originally identified a different assailant directly after the attack, but returned to law enforcement officers in May of 2023 and said Wood was the assailant, documents state. Woods was subsequently charged in connection with the incident in October. Most charges were related directly to the alleged assault, but the vehicle charge stemmed from allegations that Woods then fled Hansen's home in her vehicle. In the first day of trial testimony, Hansen said she could not definitively identify her attacker and that her memories of the assault were unclear due to the severity of the attack and extent of her injuries. Iowa District Court Judge Monica Zrinyi-Ackley oversaw the proceedings and informed Woods in the wake of the verdict that she would exonerate his bond and dismiss any no-contact orders related to the case. Couple articles from the News in Brief heading. First, police say man entered residence by upstairs window, took keys, stole vehicle in Dubuque. Police said a man broke into a woman's home and stole a vehicle last summer. Harold A. Robinson, age 38, of 2340 Central Avenue, No. 5, was arrested at 2:58 a.m. Monday in the 2700 block of Potosi Drive on a charge of providing false identification information and warrants charging second-degree burglary, second-degree theft, motor vehicle theft, driving while barred, violation of probation, and 3 counts of violation of a no-contact order. Court documents state that Robinson jumped on a chain-link fence to climb onto a roof and enter a residence through an unlocked window at approximately 6:50 a.m. June 25th. Robinson then took vehicle keys from inside the house, walked through the front door, and drove away with a vehicle, documents state. Next, Iowa legislators to hold listening session on proposed restructuring of education agencies. Local lawmakers will hold a listening session this weekend in Dubuque to discuss proposed legislation that would restructure Iowa's area education agencies, which provide special education and other services to the state's schools. The session, featuring Iowa Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, and other local legislators, will take place at 1 p.m. Sunday, January the 21st, at Carnegie Stout Public Library, 360 West 11th Street, according to a press release. The conversation will focus on legislation unveiled last week by Governor Kim Reynolds in her Condition of the State address and proposed in an Iowa House of Representatives bill. Under that bill, the state's AEAs only would be authorized to provide special education services, along with special and general education to students in juvenile detention or foster care systems. General supervision authority and $20 million from AEAs would be shifted to the Iowa Department of Education. State funds for a school district's special education services that currently are given to the AEA would remain with the district, and district officials would decide how to spend them. During Sunday's session, legislators will provide comments and education on the legislation and will invite constituents to share how AEA services have impacted them or a loved one personally, the release states. Attendees are encouraged to arrive promptly at 1 p.m. Next, authorities say illicit substances found in Platteville apartment. The dateline is Platteville, Wisconsin. Authorities said drug charges are pending against two Platteville residents after illicit substances were found in their shared home. Authorities are recommending Nicholas J. Forbes, age 29, of Platteville, be charged with possession with intent to deliver methamphetamine, possession of methamphetamine, possession of drug paraphernalia, maintaining a drug trafficking house, and four counts of soliciting a prostitute, according to a news release from the Richard, Iowa Grant Drug Task Force. Authorities also are recommending Tiffany Chandler, age 28, of Platteville, be charged with possession with intent to deliver methamphetamine, possession of fentanyl, possession of drug paraphernalia, and maintaining a drug trafficking house, the release states. The recommended charges against both Forbes and Chandler resulted from a recent search of their shared Platteville apartment, where the release states drugs and drug paraphernalia were located. The search followed an earlier January 5th traffic stop of Forbes, during which the release states he was in possession of methamphetamine. The pending charges have been referred to the District Attorney's Office in Grant and Iowa counties. Now here's Monday's developments from the Dubuque City Council. Dubuque organization to take on long-term management of ICE Center. The action, City Council members voted 7-0 to approve a management agreement with the Schmidt Island Development Corp. to take on the long-term management of I'm On Arena. Schmidt Island Development Corp. and DRA have been managing and staffing the arena on an interim basis. The new agreement officially will give long-term management responsibilities for the facility's day-to-day operations to Schmidt Island Development Corporation. The city will retain ownership of the facility and will pay for any major maintenance or capital improvements to the ICE arena. The city also agrees to pay Schmidt Island Development Corporation an annual fixed fee of $100,000 and any additional cash flow shortfalls if the facility is unable to cover its expenses through its operating revenue. The agreement will last until 2033, at which time it will come up for potential renewal. City Council approves $3.2 million for sewer projects. The action, City Council members voted 7-0 to issue up to $3.2 million in state revolving fund sewer revenue loans to pay for several sewer infrastructure projects. The funds will be used to pay for three sewer projects, the extension of sewer infrastructure to Tamarack Business Park and Crossroads Industrial Park, the connection of the city's sanitary sewer gravity system with the existing Twin Ridge Subdivision gravity sewer system, and the increasing of pumping capacity, installation of new control equipment, and other improvements at the Granger Creek lift station. What's next? Council documents did not include timelines for the planned sewer projects. The SRF loan has a term of 20 years with variable interest rate of 2.43% and an annual servicing fee of 0.25%. And zoning change allows for mini warehouses. The action, City Council members voted 7-0 to amend the city's Unified Development Code to add mini warehouses as a permitted use below the first floor of properties zoned downtown commercial or business district. Tom Rowan requested the zoning code change so he could add commercial storage space to the lower level of 962 through 980 Main Street for a planned storage mailbox, packaging, and shipping business. The city previously has not permitted commercial storage space in downtown commercial properties, but city staff recommended changing the zoning code due to decreases in demand for commercial space since the COVID-19 pandemic. What's next? Speaking with the Telegraph Herald, Rowan said he does not have a specific timeline for the development of his new business, but he hopes to be open as soon as possible. Now we turn to the opinion page, and we've got an opinion from titled Finding Slivers of Smiles in Winter. It's written by Kurt Ulrich, who is a freelance writer who resides in rural Jackson County, Iowa. Be aware, this is a column about weather, about a cold month in our lives, about snow. There have been a couple of big storms out here, which means the 72-year-old man at my place bundles up every few hours to shovel heavy, wet snow, and, being in what the medical world calls heart failure, he gets a little anxious, wondering, what in the heck am I doing? He was actually doing just fine until reading an article in a national newspaper answering the question, is shoveling snow dangerous? The answer, of course, is a resounding yes. You can know too much. The other day I watched as a doe made her way across the field in front of my house, leaping forward a few times in the deep snow before taking a break and then leaping again. After seeing her struggle, I managed to get to town and pick up a 50-pound bag of alfalfa cubes for the wild creatures that share this land with me. I gave up plowing my own lane a few years ago when it became clear that I needed to spend every moment with my wife, so I struck a deal with a neighbor. When it snows, he comes over with his big John Deere tractor and blade. Then, at the end of the season, I pay him for his winter troubles, which he, in turn, puts in a granddaughter's college fund. It's a good deal for everyone. I could return to doing the plowing myself now, but I'm tired. On the back side of my house is a screened porch, one where my wife and I spent many hours reading, listening to the sounds of insects and birds, and just generally hanging out. After she passed a few years ago, I never went out there again, letting the dust pile up, the paint on the Adirondack chairs peeling, walls getting dirty, and corners piling up with bugs. It was all rather like Miss Havisham's wedding table in Dickens's Great Expectations, the tables she left intact after she was jilted at the altar, leaving food rotting, mice taking over, and cobwebs everywhere forever and ever. Last summer, a friend convinced me to clean the porch, wash the chair cushions, and do some painting on the chairs. I added wind chimes given to me by another friend who made them and was ready to begin sitting out again. It still hasn't happened. When two falls to one, things change. Though the porch looks good in snow and does in fact cause me to look at it and say to myself, maybe this year. A few weeks back, I was in the front pew of a great church listening to a chamber orchestra and choir performing some of my favorite Baroque music. You know, European white guys, Handel, Purcell, Telemann, and Vivaldi, all of whom passed in the middle of the 18th century. It was magical stuff, lightness on the edge of melancholy. January can be a melancholy month, a sit and stare at the snow for a little while with nothing happening in your head kind of month. Perhaps you know the feeling. Toward the end of my wife's journey, I showered her every morning, lathering her beautiful long hair with shampoo, followed by a conditioner. After drying her off with a towel, she would sit down in her white terry cloth bathrobe while I blow-dried her hair. As I did this, I sang to her, the same song every time because it made her smile even during the hottest days of summer. The song? It's one you all know with terrific lyrics about love for another. Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is a new bird. To sing a love song while we stroll along, Walking in a Winter Wonderland. You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we turn to today's obituaries, and we first remember Kenneth L. Hoffman, age 74, of Dubuque, Iowa, who died Thursday, January 11th, 2024, at home. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, January the 19th, 2024, at the Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home, 2659 Kennedy Road. A public visitation for family and friends will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January the 18th. Burial will be at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Next, we remember John E. Zuby Bartles, age 79, of Moore, Oklahoma, who passed away Saturday, January the 6th, 2024, at Physicians Hospital in Anadarko, Oklahoma. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. on Friday, January the 19th, 2024, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, prior to funeral mass. Funeral services will follow at 11 a.m. at St. Francis Xavier Basilica, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Chris Podhachsky will officiate. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Camp Courageous in Monticello, Iowa. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. Now we remember Ardo A. Schmidt, age 87, of Preston, who died on Saturday, January the 13th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January the 19th, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 20th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Preston, where services will follow. Law Jones Funeral Home of Preston is assisting the family. Now we remember Charlie Chicken Risen, age 86, of Dubuque, who died Monday, January the 15th, 2024, at Mercy One Hospital after a long battle with ongoing health issues surrounded by his family. Visitation will be from 1 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Friday, January the 19th, 2024, with a prayer service at 3:30 p.m. at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road in Dubuque. The family requests you dress casual and warm. Online condolences may be left at www.leonardfuneralhome.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Avery Foundation, a Dubuque-based foundation that helps patients and families pay for incidental costs of cancer treatments. Visit https://www.averyfndtn.org for more information. And we remember Shirley Sheehan, age 87, of Dubuque, who passed away January the 12th, 2024. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19th, 2024, at the Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 JFK Road, Dubuque. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, donations will be taken for the Dubuque Arboretum and Botanical Gardens or the Dubuque Humane Society. Now here's a list of funeral services. First, William J. Ammon, Naples, Florida. Celebration of Life, 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, January the 20th. Best Western Hotel, 3100 Dodge Street, 20W. Marilyn R. Althoff, Earlville, Iowa. Visitation 2 to 8 p.m. today and from 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday, January the 18th. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Thursday, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Earlville. Robert J. Breitfelder of Dubuque. Visitation 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, January 21st. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Mass of Christian by 10:30 a.m. Monday, January the 22nd, St. Donatus, Iowa Catholic Church. Shirley I. Dack of Dubuque. Celebration of Life, 1 to 6 p.m., with a time for sharing from 1:30 to 2:30, Saturday, January the 20th, at Happy's Place. John W. Dias, Andrew, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m., Friday, January the 19th. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue. Service, 11 a.m., Saturday, January the 20th. Sisters Paul, Peter and Paul Catholic Church, Springbrook. Christopher J. Hermson, Janesville, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 a.m. to noon, Saturday, January the 20th. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory, Lancaster. Service noon, Saturday, at the funeral home. Linda M. Hertenstein, Gutenberg, Iowa. Visitation 10 to 11:30 a.m., Saturday, January the 27th, St. John's Lutheran Church, Bellevue. Service 11:30 a.m., Saturday, at the church. Elaine M. Hutchcroft, Lamont, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. today at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Key West. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. today at the church. Noel E. Kurt of Dubuque. Parish Wake Service, 3 p.m., followed by visitation until 7 p.m., Thursday, January the 18th, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m., Friday, January the 19th, Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Mary K. Lawrence, Benton, Wisconsin, visitation 3 to 7 p.m., Thursday, January the 18th, Hodden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, Wisconsin, and 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, January 19th, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Benton. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Linda Martins, Cambridge, Illinois. Visitation 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. today, Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue, Iowa. Service 12:30 p.m. today at the funeral home. And Charles E. Sieverding of Dubuque, visitation 9 to 10:30 a.m. Thursday, January the 18th at Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Bellevue. Service 11 a.m. Thursday at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bellevue. Now we turn to the sports page and top story in prep football. Freddie steps down after 19 seasons. This is written by Danny Miller. For nearly two decades, Tim Frakey has been a staple within the Cascade community. That will remain unchanged. For the foreseeable future, however, Frakey's presence at Cougar sporting events will be in the role of a father and a fan instead of a coach on the gridiron. It took Alabama about 2 days to get rid of Nick Saban, so they took about 2 minutes to forget about me, Frakey joked after resigning as Cascade's head football coach last week. Citing a desire to dedicate more time to his family, specifically to his three daughters who are all multi-sport athletes, Frakey relinquished his duties at the helm of the Cougar football program after 19 seasons. I didn't miss a lot, but it's been tough to get to Comanche on a Thursday night for my daughter's volleyball game or a tournament on Saturday morning when we have practice, Frakey said. The last couple of years, I have not been 100% committed to the football program. My assistants have been doing more and more. I'm not going to do that anymore. I can't be half in, half out as the head coach of a football program. Frakey took over the football program in 2005 in the predominantly baseball and basketball-rich Cascade community. With Jerry Rowling in baseball and Al Marsh in basketball and some of the other coaches they've had, it was a tough go to get the football program going. There were athletes here, great parents, and great community support. We just had to get the kids to care about the football program. I think we've done that. Frakey's results speak for themselves. Over 19 seasons, he compiled a record of 105 wins, 80 losses, and reached milestone win number 100 on September the 9th, 2022, against Anamosa. Frakey was responsible for 11 of Cascade's 14 postseason berths, including five straight appearances from 2011 to 2015. He was named Telegraph Herald All-Area Coach of the Year in 2008 after leading Cascade to an 8-win, 2-loss record and its first postseason berth since 1990, and again in 2017 after guiding the Cougars to a 10-win, 1-loss mark and a program-best Class 2A state quarterfinal appearance. Year in and year out, we've been pretty competitive, Frankie said. Once we got the program going, the kids and the community have just been excellent. Hopefully that continues. Frankie certainly isn't going far, however. He will continue his role as the head girls track and field coach, a position he's held for 18 seasons. His wife, Mary, recently completed her 18th season as the Cougars' head volleyball coach. Addison, his oldest daughter, currently competes in 4 varsity sports at Cascade, while Emma is on the same path as an incoming freshman next year, and Alaya, currently a 5th grader, is another multi-sport athlete. Our plan is to continue to be a part of the community and have our kids grow up and graduate from Cascade, Frankie said. Our girls all play multiple sports, and that's just big-time commitment. I think I just need to step back and provide more time to help with all those things and make sure that I'm there for my family. While he's hanging up his headset, Frankie plans to stay involved with football by getting certified as an official. While I've yelled at too many of them over my lifetime, so I'm about ready for someone to start yelling at me for a while, he said. In high school bowling, slay it for Sophie. Senior girls earn convincing victory over MVC rival Western Dubuque. It's written by Jim Leitner. Allison Hedrick wanted to bowl Sophie Strong and put yet another smile on her teammates' face Tuesday afternoon. The Dubuque senior girls bowling team delivered a convincing 2,734-2,162 victory over Mississippi Valley Conference rival Western Dubuque at Cherry Lanes. It marked the Rams' first meeting since sophomore Sophie Jasper began leukemia treatments in Iowa City following a diagnosis less than 2 weeks ago. It was tough bowling without a teammate who always comes in with a smile, said Hedrick, who led the Rams with 199-223 for a 422 series. She's always bright and optimistic. She's always the energy on the team. We stayed positive today because of her. I know she was watching us online, and that helped a lot because she's still such a huge part of our team no matter what. We know she's proud of us right now. The news hit coach Peggy Leibfried and the defending Iowa Class 3A state team champions hard, but in her typical fashion, Jasper tried to put the Rams' mind at ease. Her attitude has been amazing, Leibfried said of a bowler who first cracked the varsity lineup at the beginning of this season. The first thing she said was, "Don't worry, I'm going to slay this." That was her attitude from the get-go, and now that's the theme for our season. Slay it for Sophie. It's scary for the girls to realize that, at their age, something like this could happen. But they're such a tight-knit group, the text groups started immediately. They wanted to know what they could do to help and show their support. And it helps that they've been FaceTiming and texting with her every day to keep in touch. On Tuesday, the Rams made posters, wore bracelets, and did their hair in honor of Jasper. It's so important to have teammates support you no matter what, Hedrick said. I know it put a smile on her face while she was watching the meet. The Rams also scored individually with Clara Pregler, Mackenzie Lang, Zoe Betcher, and Maddie Arrington, while Ava Pregler's 285 did not count. Senior scored Baker Gaines of 213 to 169, 161, 171, and 198. Bailey Nyan led the Bobcats with a 138, 168 for a 306, followed by Addie Kress, Megan Vasky, Kylie Kress, and Claire McGrain, while Dicey McCool's 243 did not factor. The Bobcats rolled Baker Gaines of 138, 165, 132, 182, and 168. The Western Dubuque boys earned a 3,016-2,879 victory on the adjacent lanes. Matt Daly led the way with a 212 and a 246 for a 458, just 5 pins better than teammate Ethan Potter. In high school boys basketball, Bobcats rusty in return. It's written by Danny Miller, and the dateline is Epworth, Iowa. Western Dubuque coach Ben Wilson feared this was a possibility, and while he was proven right, his team still had a chance. In a sluggish offensive performance for both teams, WD, Western Dubuque, held a one-point advantage with 4 minutes 32 seconds to play, but visiting Cedar Rapids Prairie outscored the Bobcats 19-6 over the final stretch to pull away for a 59-47 victory in a Mississippi Valley Conference cross-divisional contest on Tuesday at Western Dubuque High School. Western Dubuque hadn't so much as practiced since last Thursday due to the treacherous snowfall over the past few days. "This was what I was worried about," Wilson said. "It's tough. Our shots were all short, we were a step slow on everything, and you could just tell our guys didn't have their legs. You can't take that many days off and expect to be successful, and that's what you saw." After holding the Hawks to just 32 points total through the first three quarters, Prairie erupted for 27 in the final frame alone. "We didn't have anything left in the tank at that point," Wilson said. "Our guys tried hard and played hard, but we didn't have legs at that point. All the things you would expect to happen when you have guys off for that long, and that's what's happened." Prairie outscored WD 27-13 in the final frame. Western Dubuque was attempting to win its fourth straight contest and push its record above the 500 mark for the first time this season. Cedar Rapids Prairie defeated the Bobcats for the seventh straight time, dating to 2016. "This was one that we really wanted," Wilson said. "It would have put us above 500, which would have been great, but in this league, there are no gimmies. Everyone is good. Everyone is really well coached." Prairie came out and hit some shots late and did what they had to do to win the game. A lackluster offensive performance from both sides led to a low-scoring first that saw the game tied 21-21 at the break. Luke Callahan's three-pointer near the end of the third quarter gave the Bobcats a 34-30 advantage heading to the fourth quarter. Kenyon Bright put the Bobcats ahead for the final time, 41-40, with the drive to the hoop at 4:32 before the Hawks scored 19 of the game's final 25 points to pull away. Bright battled through foul trouble and matched his season-high points total to lead the Bobcats with 19, while Callahan scored all 10 of his in the second half. Jace McDermott led Prairie with 15 points, and Austin Jones tallied 12. In the local and area roundup, number 1 Kennedy beats number 3 Rams. Cooper Porter drained 4 three-pointers and finished with 12 points, but Iowa Class 4A number 3 ranked Dubuque Senior suffered its first loss of the season, 57-34, against top-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy on Tuesday night in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Trey McCowan scored a game-high 17 points to lead the Cougars, who opened the game on a 12-2 run and led 31-16 at halftime. Tevin Schultz added 11 points for the Rams. Dubuque Wallert 74, Cedar Rapids Washington 52 at Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Ethan Meyer scored 16 points, Spencer Kummer added 11, and Charlie Becker had 10, and the Golden Eagles routed the Warriors. Dubuque Hempstead 65, Cedar Rapids Jefferson 61 at Moody Gymnasium. The Mustangs outscored the Jayhawks 13-9 in the fourth quarter to win their first action in 11 days. Bellevue Marquette 87, Lisbon 57 at Lisbon, Iowa. Eli Scott scored 12 of his game-high 22 points after halftime. Spencer Rader added 18 points, Caden Kettman had 14, and Isaac Brinker 12 as the defenders routed the Lions and improved to 12 wins and 0 losses. Galena 56, Warren 36 at Galena, Illinois. Connor Glasgow scored 9 of his game-high 25 points in the opening quarter as the Pirates jumped out to a 17-2 lead on the Warriors and never looked back. Southwestern 51, Fenimore 43 at Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Everett Drossler scored 16 points, Carson Splinter added 12, and Jack Rundy had 11, and the Wildcats beat the Golden Eagles. Schulzburg 77, Benton 33 at Schulzburg, Wisconsin. The Miners cruised out to a 23-point halftime lead and pulled away in the second half for a Six Rivers Conference victory over the Zephyrs. River Ridge 79, Cassville 37 at Patch Grove, Wisconsin. The Timberwolves cruised past the Comets after leading by 24 points at halftime of their Six Rivers Conference contest. In girls basketball, Dubuque Wallert 71, Cedar Rapids Washington 42 at Wallert Gym. The Class 3A number 6 ranked Golden Eagles built a 37-15 halftime lead before easing to a victory over the Warriors. West Delaware 53, Centerpoint Urbana 45 at Manchester, Iowa. The Hawks used a 19-4 third quarter run to beat the Stormin Pointers. And Maquoketa Valley 53, All Burnett 41 at All Burnett, Iowa. The Wildcats fought off the Pirates for a Tri-Rivers Conference victory. In boys swimming, Dubuque Senior 111, Cedar Rapids Jefferson 52 at Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jarrett Herber won the 50-yard freestyle and the 100 butterfly. Zach Hayer won the 500 free and 100 backstroke. And Duncan Freund won the 200 individual medley and the 100 breaststroke as the Rams routed the Jayhawks. William Fry also won and teamed with Herber, Heyer, and Freund to win the 400 relay as Senior won 10 of the 11 events. And in girls wrestling, Mustangs claim title at Sumner, Iowa. Isla Osterkamp at 135 pounds, Annabelle Blanchard at 145, and Caitlin Brokus at 235 won individual championships, and Alyssa Murphy at 100 pounds, Shayla Murphy at 120 pounds, and Paige Howison at 155 finished runners-up to help Dubuque Hempstead win the 10-team Cougar Invitational 158.5 to 150.5 over host Sumner Fredericksburg. In college football news, Hawkeyes promote Wallace. Iowa receivers coach Dalton Copeland has been let go. Defensive coordinator Phil Parker received a significant raise, and Seth Wallace has been named assistant head coach. Kirk Ferentz, who announced the moves Tuesday, also said his search for an offensive coordinator is continuing. Copeland coached the receivers for 7 years. The Hawkeyes have had one of the least productive offensive for 3 straight seasons, and no receiver ranked among the top 30 in the Big Ten in 2023. The university announced his contract would not be renewed. I appreciate Kelton's contribution to the Hawkeye staff and wish him the very best, Ferentz said in a statement. Parker, winner of the Frank Broyles Award as the nation's top assistant, received a $500,000 raise to $1.9 million. His defense led the Hawkeyes to a 10-win season, ranking in the top 10 nationally in 3 of the 4 major categories. Wallace will continue as assistant defensive coordinator and linebackers coach. His salary will increase from $755,000 to $1 million. Seth is an excellent coach and has been an asset to our coaching staff for many years, said Ferentz. He works tirelessly to develop our players into outstanding men on and off the field. I am grateful that he is a part of our program. Wallace, in the last 8 years, have coached 5 All-American linebackers, including unanimous consensus selections, Josie Jewell in 2017 and Jack Campbell in 2022. An Iowa linebacker has led the Big Ten in total tackles each of the past 3 seasons. Wallace has coached 8 players who have gone on to the NFL. Being able to coach at the University of Iowa with such great players, coaches, and staff members is really an honor, Wallace said. The University of Iowa and this football program are both very special to me. I am appreciative of this new, expanded role and look forward to preparing our athletes for the upcoming season and beyond. In men's college basketball, Drake Northern Iowa hit road for MVC tilts. Here's a capsule look at today's games. Drake at Illinois State at 7 p.m. today can be seen on ESPN+. Bottom line, Drake faces the Illinois State Redbirds after Tucker DeVries scored 34 points in Drake's 76-58 win against the Southern Illinois Salukis. The Redbirds have gone 6 wins, 3 losses in home games. Illinois State averages 12 turnovers per game and is 4 wins, 3 losses when it turns the ball over less than its opponents. Drake ranks 4th in the MVC, scoring 32.8 points per game in the paint, led by Darnell Brody averaging 8.6. Illinois State scores 66.9 points per game, 1.6 fewer points than the 68.5 Drake allows. Drake averages 10.3 more points per game than Illinois State allows to its opponents. Top performers, Dalton Banks averages 1.2 made three-pointers per game for the Redbirds, scoring 10.1 points while shooting 32.8% from beyond the arc. Darius Burford is shooting 43.1% and averages 12.8 points over the last 10 games for Illinois State. DeVries is averaging 20.4 points, 6.2 rebounds, 3.7 assists, and 1.6 steals for the Bulldogs. Atten Wright is averaging 15.5 points over the last 10 games for Drake. Northern Iowa at Belmont at 8 p.m. tonight can be seen on CBS Sports Network. The bottom line, Northern Iowa plays the Belmont Bruins after Nate Heise scored 24 points in Northern Iowa's 70-60 win against the Murray State Racers. The Bruins have 7 wins and 0 losses in home games. Belmont is 6th in the MVC with 14.6 assists per game, led by Jacoby Gillespie, averaging 4.1. Northern Iowa is 9th in the MVC, allowing 71.6 points while holding opponents to 44.2% shooting. Belmont scores 75.5 points, 6.9 more per game than the 71.6 Northern Iowa gives up. Northern Iowa has shot at a 46.9% rate from the field this season, 1.3 percentage points greater than the 45.6% shooting opponents of Belmont have averaged. Top performers, Malik Dia is averaging 17.5 points and 5.6 rebounds for the Bruins. Cade Tyson is averaging 13.3 points over the last 10 games for Belmont. Bowen Bourne is scoring 14.4 points per game with 2.8 rebounds and 1.9 assists for the Panthers. Heise is averaging 14.3 points and 5.8 rebounds while shooting 48.9% over the last 10 games for Northern Iowa. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.